Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello, my wonderful audience. It's another bright and sunny day in upstate New York. And I'm again looking out on my birds. There's a house finch out there on the feeders right now. It's been a good week. Life is good here. I hope it is good for all of you. I'm trying to take care of my health, eating well. I went to have my trainer today. Not very expensive here in upstate New York to have a trainer once or twice a week. I hope you're taking care of yourself, eating well, exercising, developing attitudes toward life that are positive. Today we'll need those positive attitudes because we're going to be talking about some pretty deep and heavy issues. You are listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour on www.prn.fm. You can call in and ask questions at 888-874-4888. You can listen live if you're not listening to PRN directly on 712-775-6850. This is for all of you who may be listening for the first or second time. And don't forget, we have BregginLive@Hotmail.com, BregginLive@Hotmail.com, our dedicated email for people to let me know what they think of the show, how things are going. And, of course, on my website, Breggin.com, tons of information, tons. And sign up for my frequent alerts. They're free. They'll keep you in touch with what I'm doing and a lot of what's happening in reform psychiatry and related fields as well. And on the website, we have the daily breaking news. My assistant, Ian, and my wife, Ginger, contribute to that. Ian runs it. I contribute once in a while. It's a very, very interesting, up-to-date look at what's going on in the world of humans. Covers the whole waterfront and animals. My guest today is Jeffrey Mason, who is M-A-S-S-O-M. Jeffrey Musief Mason. He's been on a few times, his third time in about 6 weeks, because I like to have Jeffrey on in batches. We have so much to talk about. Jeff, are you there?
I am here, Peter.
Oh, you sound crystal clear. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, my son taught me how to use headphones, my 17-year-old. He teaches me everything. So I have headphones now, and it's just about to turn into a beautiful sunny morning in Sydney, Australia, and the birds will come here, and I hear the ocean beyond me, Tamarama Beach. It's 6 in the morning now, but I'm thrilled to be talking to you, Peter, my hero.
Oh, God bless you, Jeffrey. You make me blush on the show. I mean, You're very, very loving and very generous. We've known each other for decades.
True.
Yeah. Yes. I'm just looking now,
You're the only psychiatrist I know who has taken on many of the most important issues that others shy away from. Even if they agree with you, they say, I don't want to stick my neck out. I have to think of my family. I know it's the truth, but I daren't speak it. You're the only one for maybe more than 50 years now has stood up for the truth. I just admire you so much, Peter.
Thank you. And it's a blessing that I've been alive. They tried to do me in years and years ago.
I'll bet.
But they failed at that point physically, and then they tried my medical license, and they just lost terribly in that battle, thanks to Ginger's getting PR from everybody, the New York Times to congressional people standing up for my right to speak the truth about psychiatry as I see it. But looking at Jeffrey's books here, folks, if you just look at all the jacket covers, The Assault on Truth was the book that really changed my opinion on psychoanalysis. No, it didn't. I always thought psychoanalysis was a cult, but I didn't realize that Freud was a betrayer of everything good in therapy when he created the Oedipus complex that little children lust after their parents, and he did it to cover up child abuse. He knew they were being abused, and he made up this. And Jeffrey and I have talked about this in earlier shows. You can get them on Bregan.com, and we'll talk about it again, but not much today. But that was a profound insight for me. And then after a while, we talked about yesterday, last time we talked, Jeff just decided to go ahead and write things he wanted to write about. And great books, When Elephants Weep, but just a marvelous book about the feelings of animals. Dogs Never Lie About Love, which actually enabled me to love my dogs even more. What a gift that was. The Pig Who Sang to the Moon, about the abuse of animals. The Face on Your Plate, about vegetarianism. The books go on, and they're all good. I've read more of Jeffrey than of any other author. I don't know if I've said that before here, but I have. And lots and lots of wonderful books about animals, about life, about what's the matter with concepts of therapy, over a wide variety of subjects. I wanted to start out talking just briefly. I had mentioned this to Jeff in advance, that to talk briefly about the Michelle Carter case. A week ago, we saw parts one and two of the film on HBO, and now you can just get it so many different ways now that it's been on the actual HBO, and it's the film is called I Love You Now Die, and it's about the Michelle Carter case, and about the girl who supposedly, you'll find out there's really not much evidence for it, supposedly told her boyfriend to go back into his fume-filled truck and kill himself. And he did kill himself. He'd made four attempts before he ever met Michelle. Maybe three, and then the fourth, he just shortly after he met her, and when they were still very innocent. They were both on psychiatric drugs. He was beaten up by his father so badly, had a concussion, and charges were brought against him by the police 4 or 5 months before his suicide. And he just had a very isolated, tough life. And Michelle gets blamed for doing what she actually said she was trying to help him do. And we've got hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of texts that I read showing how she gradually got drawn into his web, which was, if you love me, you'll never tell anybody I'm suicidal and you'll help me die. And both of them bamboozled by drugs, both of them very disturbed. They started out as really innocent kids texting, and then they both got on psych drugs. He had a suicide attempt, and on Prozac, and I think it was, and she was on Prozac. They talked together on the phone when they were both on Prozac, both seeing the devil, he telling her the devil wanted them to be together. Just a dreadful tragedy of isolated kids. And it's very well covered in the film. And they give me a generous amount of time in the 2.25 hours spread over two nights to talk about a variety of issues. And for the first time, get out in the open what I would call the martyrdom of America's children. It is a tragedy, the forces coming to bear on our kids. And who gets blamed? 17-year-old Michelle Carter, manslaughter conviction. Convict the whole society. Convict the DA who lied about her to get a conviction. Lied about her character. Lied about what was even in the texts, claiming that she lied about things when she hadn't. It's just a mess. And America's children are really suffering now from too much exposure to sex, to violence, to betrayal, too much isolation from their families and the social media, schools that are less and less caring, a lack of the kinds of things that can bolster kids when they're young, whether it's religion, a belief in God, or patriotism, all this being assaulted, which are often mainstays of sanity for young people, and ripping everything out of the value system. It's just an incredible tragedy. And we talked some about this last week with Bob Whitaker. And those of you who know Bob know what a great thinker he is, and a brave journalist, and really a good scientist. And you just might want to listen to last week's show. I rarely mention the show from the week before, but this one's a good one to go to on the archives. So, Jeff, that's sort of stuff that's been on my mind. And today I want to give the folks kind of a little prelude on things we may talk about. You know, there are two psychiatrists that in the past have been adored in America, and I certainly didn't know much about their true human natures. One's Carl Jung, and the other is Frankl. You know, Carl Jung, the psychiatrist who broke with Freud, as we'll hear maybe as we talk about it, maybe more because of anti-Semitism than because of their differences, which were legion, and who was more spiritually oriented, but was it a good spirituality? And Frankl, who taught us about survival in the concentration camps. Well, Jeff has some new information about Frankl and his survival. That would be interesting. And Jeff has also been reading about Asperger, the man who created Asperger's disorder. And what was he about? He's tied into this whole picture about Nazis and psychiatrists. And I'll get around to talking some about the psychiatric role in the Holocaust. You may have heard me talking about it before, but this is always new and original. And if you go on to my website, and you can easily find my role on psychiatry's role in my great paper I'm very proud of. Jeffrey had a lot to do with helping me because he speaks in German and he translates German, and I don't do that, and he was very helpful to me. But psychiatry's role in the Holocaust is the paper, and if you put that in under the search, psychiatry's role in the Holocaust, you'll get there very fast. And it's about a 16-page, extremely annotated paper on how psychiatry organized the first stage of the Holocaust. It organized the systematic murder of mental patients. And that led to the success of that, which was done on their own. There was no orders from Hitler. They did it on their own. They'd been thinking about that since at least 1920, before Hitler came to power. They organized the systematic murder of mental patients using gas chambers, wooden soap. The gas chambers were from trucks, not from the later sophisticated methodology when heavy industry got involved. They got the whole thing started. They proved it could be done. And we'll talk more about that today, too. So I just want to be sort of open-ended with Jeff. That's, I think, when we're at our best. And so I'm going to take a little breath and relax and look at my goldfinches. Jeff, I have four goldfinches on my feeders right now. They're like canaries. They look like canaries. But they're not caged. They're not caged. So let me give it over to Jeff. Hi there, thing. My friend.
Hello.
How do we get into the dark side of humanity without depressing everybody?
You know, the thing is, it's so difficult to know what somebody is really like until you've lived with them or you've lived around them. And, you know, people have used the term, I'm fascinated by this new book about Asperger. It's called Asperger's Children, The Origin of Autism in Nazi Vienna, by an American historian, Edith Schiffer. She's at the University of California at Berkeley, and she just published this book, which is absolutely fascinating because, you know, my wife is a pediatrician. She specializes in treating children on the autism spectrum, which is now where Asperger's is, that term Asperger. But it's been removed from the diagnostic manual in the United States, but it's still in the WHO. And people thought there was nothing wrong with it. You often hear kids saying he's a little bit aspy, or he or she is Aspergian, as if that were a good thing, not necessarily a bad thing. That is, they're a little bit shut up in themselves, they're extra shy, or something of that kind. But in fact, what this woman shows in this new book is that Asperger was not the hero that we thought he was, who saved children. He did exactly the opposite. He was a pediatrician in Vienna, and what he did was he sent at least 44 children, transferred them to a hospital known Am Spiegelgrund, which is where these children were murdered. They were either gassed right away or they were given drugs that killed them within a few weeks. He knew this, of course. It was part of Nazi psychiatry at the time, and he allowed this to happen to many of the children that he was mandated to observe. So what the Nazis did is they said any child under three who shows signs of mental or physical disability had to be sent to a special children's ward for observation. And this is exactly what he was mandated to do. And at least 789 of these children were murdered at this hospital for children called Spiegelgrund in Vienna. And here's a typical example. He examined a two years old, and concluded she needs to be permanently placed at Spiegelgrund. It's absolutely necessary, and she died 2 months later. Now, it is true that some of the children who, for one reason or another, he liked, he would save them. So people are now saying in reviews, if you go into the New York Times and look this up, you'll even find some scientists writing about this, say, yes, he killed children, but he also saved others, as if somehow that makes up for it. If you kill 44 and you save four, then you're a hero. Now, it's true that nobody knew this until right now. So the reason that he's even known at all is because Lorna Wing, who was a well-known, she died, when did she die? I think about 4 or 5 years ago. But in 1981, she published a paper, and she talked about a ridiculous paper that this man, Asperger, published in 1944. So at the height of Nazi Germany, he published a paper called Autistic Psychopathy. Now, if you just think about that, Peter, what a horrible title, Autistic Psychopathy. It was only about four patients exhibiting what today we would call Aspergian traits, but he called it Autistic Psychopathy. Why Lorna Wing chose this obscure paper and lauded it, it's to me, I just don't understand it. But nobody, definitely did not know the background. I don't know how she came across this paper, but she translated, and that became the term that everybody was using. But of course, what he meant is that these children are little psychopaths. He even used the word evil, and he sent many of them to their death. So we've just found that out now. And it's one more instance for you and me, Peter, of how careful we have to be of psychiatrists labeling people. And this began, as you said, began before Hitler, there were psychiatrists and doctors in Germany talking about lebensunwertes Leben, probably the ugliest phrase in all of German history, a life not worth living. And I remember the first time I read that, I thought, in whose opinion is a life not worth living? And you know, that this hideous idea that there are experts in the world who get to decide whether you should live or die, based on characteristics such as shyness or even any kind of, you know, deafness, blindness, curvature of the spine. In fact, some of these kids later, these were children sometimes as old as 13 or 14, and they didn't want to participate in the Hitlerjugend. Well, that was a sign that they were suffering from autistic psychopathy and therefore should be killed. So it really was, it was something. And Peter, I wanted, because you were one of the first people to ever notice that this killing of children went on even after the war in Vienna. I didn't know that. I think very, very few people in the world knew that. How you managed to find that, I don't know. But you have this genius nose, Peter. You're able to find things that other people overlook or don't want to see. You know, for me, my motto for you, Peter, is just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not there. You have this ability to go behind the scenes and pick out what's essential. Now, what people have always said about Nazi psychiatry and the killing of mental patients, which is the most terrible, along with the killing of the Jews, which is how it began, by the way. They first gassed these poor German citizens, children and adults, who showed any signs of deviation from the Nazi norm. But, of course, they claim that it was mercy killing, and that's why I'm so nervous about euthanasia even today, Peter. I have to tell you, I'm not happy to see that in Belgium today they're starting euthanasia for children for the first time ever since the Nazis for psychiatric reasons. So there was a famous case now of a 16-year-old girl who was deeply depressed, as children will be, especially when they're put on drugs or they have a difficult family life or for whatever reason. And they said two psychiatrists, Belgium today, it was last year, said her depression was treatment resistant. That is, they couldn't figure out how to treat her. She asked to be killed, and her parents agreed, and they allowed it. I think this is a horrendous crime against humanity. So, you know, even for dogs, Peter, I mean, you know, I hate to be wandering all over the place, but...
No, you're doing great, Jeff. Keep going, yeah.
It makes me nervous. I tell you, I have a 14-year-old golden lab who was a miserable failure at being a guide dog because he was just too gentle. They told me, he's too soft for our program, and I thought, that's the kind of dog I like. It's a soft dog. I wrote a book about him called The Dog Who Couldn't Stop Loving. Well, he's now 14. He's living with our son in Berlin because we're living in Australia, and the vet wouldn't let us bring him back because he's too old and frail. And I tell my son, don't let them convince you to give him euthanasia until he lets you know that he's ready. When he can't move, he can't eat, he's in obvious pain, he can't do anything, that may be the moment. But be very cautious about deciding on someone else's authority, he's ready for euthanasia. Now, I know many of the people listening will believe that they know when their cat or dog is ready, and I'm sure that there are times when we do. But I would not let any expert convince you against your better judgment and against the signs that that person is ready. My mother was 97 with severe dementia for 10 years, but she was happy. And I remember at the very beginning of it, she had it for 10 years. At the very beginning, I said, Mom, would you like to die? And she looked at me in horror. She said, are you insane? She enjoyed her life to the last day in spite of dementia. So I'm very nervous about euthanasia. Precisely. And by the way, Peter, this is astonishing to me. the Belgian expert decide for the government when euthanasia is necessary, even in cases of psychiatric depression, took a group of 40 nurses and doctors to Auschwitz for a discussion about euthanasia. I take it that he is not aware of the history of euthanasia, and somebody should alert him to your marvelous, I still think it's the best article ever written about this, the article you wrote. And by the way, the best book ever written about it is by a man who just died called Benno Müller-Hill, who was a great geneticist at the University of Cologne in Germany. And he wrote a tiny little book called Murderous Science about the killing of mental patients in Germany that you and I both read. And I thought it was the finest book I've ever read about this topic. And he told me when you and I met him, and you might talk about this because it was such a fascinating trip that we met, I think, when we first got to know each other, that was in Germany, talking about psychiatric killing. And Benno Müller-Hill was practically in tears when he talked to us about how the book was received. He said, they called me a nest beschmutzer. That means somebody who fouls your own nest. That is, he was discussing matters that showed German psychiatry and German science at that time, that is during the Nazi period, in a very bad light. But his great achievement was to show that many of these psychiatrists who participated in this went on to have stellar careers in Germany after the war. Now, let me be clear, this could not happen in Germany today. As a Jew, I was very reluctant to go to Germany. Now I'm married to a German. I go to Berlin all the time. It's a very, very different country today. It's the only country, I think, that recognized what they did during World War II. France has never come to grips with it. Even Italy hasn't. Spain very reluctantly did, only after Franco died. So it's difficult for people to see the truth, Peter. And at some point, I'd like you to explain why you, of all people, are able to do this. You're the only psychiatrist I know. There probably are a few others, but I don't know them. You're the only one who can face clearly both the history of your own science, because you remain a psychiatrist. I could never do that. I quit psychoanalysis. But you remain because you're the conscience, and you have to be there. But very few ever in the history of it have ever been able to look back or look at the present and say, this is what happened, this is what's going on. And I'd like to understand at some point, maybe we can talk about this one day, what made you able to see what other people cannot see? That's my little speech for today. Now enough of me.
No, there isn't enough of you, Jeff. Oh, boy. I hope people aren't on the edge of their chairs. The same thing would apply to you. Why were you the first and probably still only person to get trained as a psychoanalyst and to then see how evil one of the very core ideas of it were, that like children were lusting after their parents, the so-called Oedipus complex, when in fact these were examples of child abuse where the kids had been lusted after and abused by adults, often relatives.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, Peter, just let me break in for one second. It's reminiscent of what's happening right now with the Me Too movement. I think it's so fantastic that at last victims and people who've always seen it have a voice and are being heard and are being listened to, whereas these men who denied it for years got away with it. Even yesterday, Jeffrey Epstein suddenly back in court, and Acosta had to resign, thank God, for making a sweetheart deal with him. So these things are always happening in society, but the people who benefit from it, that's still my favorite phrase in Latin, qui bono, who benefits? So who benefits when these predators get to do what they're doing. And unfortunately, it's most of the powerful forces in society that benefit from this. And the few voices that say no, like the feminists, by the way, Peter, I wasn't by any means the first person to notice what was happening, but you were careful. You said the first psychoanalyst, and that's true. But there were feminists before me in the 70s who were saying exactly that, and they didn't get much attention. Kate Millett did this and had a very difficult time, as I know from my friendship with her. And, of course, there are great feminists today like Catherine MacKinnon who recognized this. Florence Rush in the early 70s gave a paper about Freud's seduction theory, and the women cheered it, but it made no impact on the wider society, or certainly not on psychoanalysts who didn't want to hear anything about this. And at some point, Peter, this makes me think of something that you are uniquely qualified to discuss. Why is it that the animal rights movement, of which I feel I'm a small part, has been so successful, whereas the anti-psychiatry movement, which started also in the 70s, has not been successful? It's more or less disbanded. You remain as practically, as I said, the only psychiatrist still speaking out and speaking the truth. And you're 83, you know, or 82, right? I mean, 83. Where are the young psychiatrists today who say, right on, Peter Bregan, I totally agree with you. It's time to do some house cleaning in psychiatry. That doesn't happen. And it didn't happen. Look, in psychoanalysis, I found hundreds of letters by Freud. I shouldn't say I found them. Anna Freud gave them to me. That's for another talk. But when I presented these to psychoanalysts, they yawned. Oh, this is so uninteresting. I said, how can you say that? These are letters by Freud indicating that he knew perfectly well that children were being abused. How is this not important? It's one of the central themes of all times, because children have always been abused. But Freud recognized it in 1896. Why are we not paying attention to this? And the reason, of course, is the analysts didn't want to shake the foundations of psychoanalysis. They were comfortable. They were making a good living, qui bono. They were benefiting by this, and they were not willing. So what they did was, you know, they attacked the messenger. That was me, and eventually drove me out of psychoanalysis. I'm very glad because I got to go. I went to the dogs. Best place to go. If anything bad happens, you go to the dogs. I love that. Anyway, Peter, you talk now. Enough of Jeff Mason.
Well, there's so many different things. I want to disrupt a little bit the wonderful flow between us and say that I think the Me Too movement is very complex and has some horrible implications to it, because it's being used in the United States continually now by the progressive movement to say that if a woman accuses a man, you must believe her no matter what. That's what they're saying. You must believe her with no evidence. You must believe her despite contrary evidence. And they have really been using it to try to knock off conservative judges, conservative politicians, and so on. They've literally done away with innocent until proven guilty, and have actually just defied that and said that's not true. You have to listen to the woman. So it's become a real perversion, I think, for political purposes that is now going to, I think, we'll have a backlash, which may indeed set back the awareness of the reality of the common abuse of authority and power that men have over women in many settings. So just to, you know.
Hello?
Hi. I'm on.
Hi, you faded for a minute, Peter.
I'm on the air, Jeff.
I just lost you for about 10 seconds. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, I was talking about you're there.
Yeah, no, I heard what you said about the dangers of it.
Yeah, so it's been really a horror show here where some very decent men have nearly had their lives ruined, certainly scarred forever, by what appear to be baseless accusations that
Peter, so we won't get into an argument about this because I disagree, but note that you said appears to be baseless. That is part of the problem. You see, they used to do this to children, too. A child would accuse...
Jeff, today. I watched hours of hearings of a woman claiming that she'd been abused by a man when they were young, and she couldn't explain why she was even at the place she was at, where the place was, when it happened, how she got there, how she got back. She said two or three people witnessed it. They all denied witnessing it. 40 women wrote in spontaneously that this was a great judge and had done more for women in the becoming lawyers and becoming top lawyers than anybody ever. It was a horror show, Jeff. It's really being abused.
I do believe you're obviously correct. There are cases, but I think we have to be cautious because those cases represent a very small number. Just as there are children who occasionally,
In the political arena. There are a very small number in the general population. Most people who come forward with an abuse story come forward fearfully and reluctantly. None of these women came forward within 10 years. In her case, I think it might have been 25 years of the events. So, yes, that's definitely true. But this in this country now, Jeff, the climate has changed, and the use of the term racism and the use of and you know I've been fighting racism longer than most people in the world, and wrote the book with Ginger on the war against children of color. So I got great credentials.
Right.
But right now we're in a country where people are being destroyed on the basis of false accusations of racism and false accusations of sexual abuse from which they can never escape. So anyway, this is something that's very, very upsetting to me and to Ginger, who's obviously a woman, about what's been going on in the political arena. Outside the political arena, I do believe, and I have long talked about, I was friends with Kate Millett too, and Kate loved my work, the great feminist. And I hope she would still love my work. But there's something going on in America now, which is the politics of destruction around those two themes. And it's really causing, it's just completely disrupting what's going on. There's a huge fight now within the Democratic Party even over some of the charges of racism that are coming up. So it's a real mess right now. And you can't let go of innocent until proven guilty. You cannot let go of that, whether it's Jew saying it or a woman saying it or a black person saying it.
I'm thinking of what Trump just said, and Nancy Pelosi called it racist. I don't see any other word for that when you say, go back to your own country.
He didn't say
that it was wrong.
This is what's going on, Jeff. He didn't say that. Yeah. He said, go back to where you came from. And he was actually referring, at least with three of the four people who were U.S. born, go back to your cities, go back to your urban settings, make things better there before you tell us how to run the country. He didn't say, go back to your country. This is what's going on in this country right now.
Shitholes. And remember, he did call them shitholes. Remember that.
He called them, didn't call them shitholes. He called, I just listened to his whole talk. He didn't. He called them something that was, I thought was just out of bounds. But what was it? It wasn't that. Yeah. God, what did he call him? I just listened to it on the air. I listened to the whole thing. But I don't want to get too far into this.
No.
He never identified race with these people. These are four extreme progressives. Some of them are terrible anti-Semites, and he called them on that. He said they hate Jews, or this or that person hates Jews, and they do. I mean, he's actually calling people.
No,
so
they don't.
We have a vast disagreement on that. I'd like to let it go now.
Yes.
But
let's let it go. Okay. Yes.
This country is so divided that I'll probably lose half the listeners over this. Quite literally.
But I'll get them, so that's okay, Peter. They'll be on my side. But I think it's wonderful that we can still be friends even if we disagree so deeply on this.
Yes, I think it is absolutely wonderful. I think it's very, I think it's good for us to talk about it. I'm not sure about whether it helps what I'm trying to do in the reform movement. Ginger and I talk about this all the time, but when you came out with saying what you were saying with such certainty, I didn't feel like I could in good conscience not respond. But
we've tried
to stay out of this because it's so negative right now. In terms of the hate that's being generated on the left toward more conservative and libertarian people, that hate is so heavy now that I not only couldn't be on a college campus, Jeff, because of my anti-pharmaceutical company stuff, but I can't be on a camp. I couldn't talk on a campus because of my political beliefs. It's that bad in this country now. We don't have freedom of speech on our campuses. So it's tough here. It's really out of balance. I don't know if you knew that. People with conservative views don't get on the campuses. The number of them, even women, have been assaulted. It's what's happening here right now is a degree of hate that is very scary. People do not walk around with Trump buttons on in America now. It's that bad, Jeff. I wouldn't wear a Trump button or a Trump hat. So literally, that's what's happening here, Jeff. So it never gets covered by CNN, which is a main source of foreign news, news for people outside the U.S. or the New York Times. But you can't put out an American flag in a lot of parts of the country now, including pretty much around here where I am at the university place like Ithaca. So it's complicated. Maybe some of my listeners will write in about this, especially those of you who think that this is terrible. I'm saying these things. But remember, you've got that open line email, and you can email me at breganlive@hotmail.com. This is the most, Jeff, that I've ever talked about this kind of stuff on the air. And we talk about it a lot right now, my wife and I, because you know how I tend to believe in speaking truth. There's a few things going on now that it's very dangerous to speak your opinion about in America. And one of them is to defend Donald Trump in any way at all, because people get beaten up for it. People's houses, people get find crowds out in front of their houses. It's just not a safe thing to do. And we've thought a lot about whether to speak openly about it. But today I just find myself talking about it. Ginger definitely doesn't think we should be talking about it, that God's given me other purposes, which is the reform of psychiatry, the defense of mental patients and people who are being abused by the psychiatric system. Because as you've said, no one else has ever done it from my position.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Well, so I tend to stay with that, but it'll be interesting to see whether I've lost a bunch of listeners right now. That'll be very interesting.
Let me know what happens, Peter. Let me know what happens.
Okay. One of the things that this leads into very naturally is this whole question that you and I agree on and puzzle over, which is what is the matter with human beings? And by the way, Jeff, I don't have a good answer to why I am the way I am, why I have seen with clarity so many things that seem obvious. I think almost the better question is, why aren't other people seeing it? I mean, it's so what you saw with Freud was very obvious. Anna probably read her father's letters. I don't know. Did Anna Freud read her father's letters?
You know, that's a very, very... You always put your finger on the most important point, Peter.
All right.
Other people don't see it, you see it. You know, I don't think anyone has ever asked that question.
Mm.
And I wish, as you ask me now, I thought, idiot, why didn't you ask her when you had the chance? So Anna Freud, yes, she did see the letters. Of course she did. She read them. But it didn't sink into her because I can still remember the moment I sat in front of her and she said, what did you find? She was very direct. She had no time for small talk, except about dogs. One day I'll tell you the story of why she liked me. Only one reason, because I petted her chow, and she said, oh, you like dogs? I said, yes. She said, sit down, we'll talk. Otherwise, she would have thrown me out. But I showed her a letter where Freud talked about a three-year-old who had been viciously assaulted by her father and nearly died. She was anally raped, and she nearly bled to death. And Freud said, poor child. He quoted the famous verse of the great poet Goethe, poor child, what have they done to you? And Anna Freud took a red pencil and crossed it out. And I said, Miss Freud, with all due respect, this is the most beautiful thing your father ever said. How can you take it out of the public record? And she looked at me in horror, and she said, because it was untrue. And I said, again, with all due respect, Miss Freud, I'm a young analyst, and you're the great daughter of a great man. How can you decide for history it was wrong of your father to say when those words? Let people decide for themselves. And she said, okay. If that's what you want, you may have them. And I thought that was an amazingly generous act on her part. She had to be horrified at what I was about to do, that is to make these letters of Freud for the first time available to everyone to decide for themselves whether Freud was right or wrong in that important instance, the most important in Freudian history, where he said this child was raped by her father and nearly died. Was this a fantasy of the child, or was it the truth? And Anna Freud was removing that from the public record, and I put it back. But the thing is, she could not accept, when you say, did she read it? Yes, she read it, but it didn't occur to her that her father really believed this at the time. Whether he was right or wrong is a different matter. But it's not up to us to decide to remove items from the historical record because we don't think they're appropriate. Do you see what I'm saying, Peter?
Oh, my God, yes, of course, of course. And she wanted you to remove the entire reference to the rape?
She did that. You see, what happened is in 1950, a long time ago, Anna Freud published a selection of the letters to Fleece, the most important letters that Freud ever wrote, at the very beginning of psychoanalysis. And she called it The Origins of Psychoanalysis, considered the most important book on the history of psychoanalysis. But she left out 165 letters. And she said, I'm leaving them out because they're of no historical importance or they're completely personal. And when I asked her to see those letters she left out, of course, for years she wouldn't show them to anybody. Finally she said, okay, I'll let you see them. And she did. And that was the letter that I saw, which was so important. And I took it to her and I said, Miss Freud, there is no way on earth that anybody could claim this is not an important historical document. And she said, yes, but my father was wrong about child abuse. I said, well, you may believe that. I don't believe it. Let people make up their own minds. And she said, okay, you can publish the full letters. And I did. From Harvard University Press in 1985.
So, I mean, it gets us down to the question, which I think is in many ways the hardest, which is why do the vast majority of human beings flee, put the truth on such a low level of importance? I mean, it's obvious that it is on a very low level of importance, at least for people in power. I guess it has to do with maintaining that power and authority, I say, I guess.
Exactly.
I've thought tons about this, but it's very hard to get it, you know.
Well, I think when you have, look, psychoanalysis, I wouldn't call it a cult, as you called it, but I would say it was a guild. So you become, I mean, it took me 10 years to finish my training and become a psychoanalyst. And I remember various people telling me, you'd be an idiot to give this up, Jeff. You can make a living for the rest of your life. You're the director of the Freud Archives. Why would you throw that away just because you believe the truth is different than what analysts believe? And it's true that at that moment I had to think very hard. Well, they have a point. They've asked me to live in Anna Freud's house when she dies, to turn it into a scholarly center. I would have a very easy life. I would I'd be able to take care of my family. I could do historical research. But I would have to deny what I knew to be the truth. And I thought I could not live with myself. But this ability to deny the truth, an unconscious level, to use a Freudian term, is still one of the great mysteries of the world. There are people who sincerely believe that, for example, Freud was wrong about child abuse. They sincerely believe it. But in order to believe that, they have to look away from the historical record. And I was saying, look, read these letters. If at the end of reading them you still think Freud was wrong, okay, you're entitled to that. But don't hide from the truth. That's the most important thing. And I got bullied for doing that. They said, you have no right to even find these letters. That they went that far as to saying these letters don't really exist any longer because you have given them the wrong interpretation. I said, possibly I have. Read them for yourself. That's why I published them with Harvard University Press. Peter, the weird thing is, psychoanalysts did not even review that book, hardly. Nobody was interested. They said, oh, we prefer Anna Freud's original edition, which omitted 156 letters. Honestly, that is what some of them said. Don't read Jeffrey Mason's edition because it's complete. Read the selection that Anna Freud decided was for our own good.
How did you ever get it published by the Harvard University Press? Did they not realize the importance of it?
Yes, of course they did. Well, Anna Freud gave me permission, and the weird thing is, for 1 year, I was the darling of psychoanalysis because Kurt Eisler, the great old man, had appointed me to be his successor to the Freud Archives. So when they heard that in London, the director of the Freud copyright made me a director of the Freud copyright. So I then controlled what was published. Anna Freud gave me permission. I was the director of the copyright. I was director to be of the Freud Archives. So Harvard said, of course we'll publish that.
Yeah,
and they did.
Yeah.
And I remember the director, Rosenthal, taking a copy to Shimon Peres, who was the president of Israel at the time, and said, look what we have, Freud's complete letters. But the analysts, when they saw what was in those letters, and I deliberately, in that book called The Complete Letters of Sigmund Freud to Wilhelm Fliess, in that book published by Harvard, I did not give my opinion, hardly at all. I simply said, here are the letters, read them for yourself. They throw a whole new light on various important matters, especially the sexual abuse of children. Read and make up your own mind. And analysts said, no, we prefer not to read these letters. So you very rarely find that book referred to in psychoanalytic articles. They still refer to the 1950 edition, Bowdlerize, which omitted the 156 letters. And Anna Freud, I mean, she was very courageous, but she took a lot of flack for that. I shouldn't say subsequent years because she died shortly afterwards, but I was blamed for her death, which is ridiculous. But she was upset. I don't think she was upset with me.
Do you have any idea she knew she was dying at the time she gave you permission?
Yes, yeah, she was a very old woman. And she said, I can't understand why you want these, but okay, people have been asking for them for some years. I've always resisted it, but you seem like an honest man. You're a good scholar. You discovered all kinds of important documents that go along with this. Go ahead and publish them. And she said, and you like dogs.
Yeah.
But, I mean, she was a very difficult personality. She was very cool. And I first met her with my ex-wife, who was a survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto, Jewish. And we asked Anna Freud, why is it that very, very few analysts have written anything about the Second World War of any value? And she looked at us, and she was not surprised. She said, because psychoanalysis deals with fantasy, not the real world. And I was shocked. I was very deeply shocked. And that was when I was just a student of psychoanalysis. I mean, I was in training.
Yeah. And I Jeff, thought, in your experience, were analysts just actually telling their female patients that these were fantasies, that they were never touched?
Oh,
or
constantly, Peter.
It's just
I got
appalling.
Letters. I got hundreds of letters from women after my book was published, The Assault on Truth, saying my analyst told me when I told him what my uncle, my father, my brother, a neighbor, my grandfather, a stranger did to me, he said, that is a fantasy, and we have to examine why you feel it's necessary to retain this false memory. So they would write, I'm so grateful that now I realize that at least Freud, in the beginning, believed I was 100% correct. I mean, we always knew that Freud believed it for a few years, but I was able to bring all these letters that Anna Freud gave me to show that the belief was far deeper than anybody realized.
And well, and you also showed that he turned his belief around when he was scorned for it, which is the key.
Exactly, exactly. He literally scorned. He wrote a letter that also Anna Freud took out and I put back, saying these damn psychiatrists, they can all go to hell. I told them the truth about child abuse and they mocked me. And she took that out. I said, why did you take that out? That's what your father believed. He said that. He was there. And she said, it wasn't true. I said, how do you know it's not true? She said, well, it sounds paranoid. And so I was able to quote so many people.
Oh, there we go. We're coming to an end with Jeffrey Mason.
Okay.
I'm very happy to say that after all the discussion on politics, the number of people listening to the show went up when it has often trailed off toward the end. And folks, have a little dialogue with me on the on my website, on my email, on BreganLive@hotmail.com about these political issues and should I shut up or not. Meanwhile, Jeffrey Mason, wonderful writer, wonderful researcher, a great man, a good man. Thank you for being on the show again. And you will be on again and again as time goes on. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Peter. It was a great pleasure to talk to you, as always. Bye now.
Bye-bye.